Welcome, good citizens. It's another sunny day in the middle of December, so be sure to put on your shorts, stay away from the sun, sunblock is in short supply, and pledge your continuing loyalty to the authority. We're here to take good care of you. If that means tying a few fallopian tubes in the process, well, it's for the continuing perseverance of the human race. Reports of rebellion are greatly exaggerated. We're doing everything we can to keep you obeying. And isn't that a small price to pay to keep the human race marching onwards for a better tomorrow? Okay, so I am here with Sarah Hall, who is the author of Hawswater, the Electric Michelangelo, and most recently, well, this is a bit of a controversy, is it the Carhollan Army or is it Daughters of the North? Sarah, how are you doing, and what is the preferential title for this? I mean, what's safe?
I'm very well, thank you. You know what? I like both titles. I know this is me sitting on the fence and being very politic, but I think they work for the two different markets. You know, I think Carhollan is kind of a tough word. Even people in the UK are having trouble pronouncing it, so I think Daughters of the North works better over here in the US.
But you could always go the whole distance and have the Carhollan Daughters of the North. What about that?
Yeah, that would work too,
that
but then
be a bit of a mouthful, you know?
It's a bit of a mouthful.
Was this a kind of bookseller's scenario that they would only be able to remember Daughters of the North more than Carhollan? Do you know any reasons why? Was there fights for this particular title? I mean, I have to know.
No, there were no real fights. I mean, I had a conversation with my publisher in the US, and we both decided that it was going to be easier. And strangely enough, when I first started the project, it looked like it was going to be a short story, and the short story was called Daughters of the North, and the thing kind of expanded to become the novel that it is, and the title switched, so Daughters of the North actually was the first title, a working title for the piece. There were no real fights, I'm sad to report, you know, there were no slamming down of phones or anything like that.
Oh, okay, but yeah. You look really, you're scowling at me right now, you're not. I actually wanted to ask a general question, then we'll get into really specific aspects within the text, but your books, all three of them, are not set in the present day, and I find this to be interesting, and I'm wondering, I mean, the first two are set roughly around before World War II or thereabouts, and this book is set in the future, and I must ask you, well, why not write something in the present? Do you think that that might be too easy for you? Does the act of setting involve a aspect of difficulty in setting out to write a book? Or?
I don't know if too easy, maybe too difficult. Although, having said that, the fourth novel that I'm working on now is partly set current-day London. So,
finally
I'm getting there. But I suppose, I mean, I think the exercise of writing a novel, the rules apply no matter the novel you're writing. So you still have to create this world. You know, what you want is the reader to open the door, step into the world, close the door, and it's a world entire, and it's exciting to be there. So whether that's present-day, past, or future, you know, it's the same principle. But maybe it's my upbringing. I was brought up in the north of England in a very kind of strange remote community, and so it was kind of modern, but it felt like it was holding on to the past more than some other places, I suppose. And so I've kind of felt comfortable. You know, the farmers still dress the same. They're dressed in these tweed suits that you would have found in the 1930s.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think I always had that sense of kind of living in the past a little bit.
So really, I mean, because you do have a concern for environmental details in all of your books, and this strikes me as interesting in light of this idea of, well, when do you set this? Because if the environment itself isn't really changing, I mean, one could almost argue that the dilapidated environment in Daughters of the North, and I'll refer to it as that, is really an echo of what you portray in Hawswater, of this environment that is gutted out by machinery and the like. And maybe we can talk about, well, of course, there's the Nabokov principle, where Nabokov said that he could not set out and write a book unless he absolutely knew the lay of the land, the topography, and all that. And I'm wondering if this is a similar concern that you need to have before venturing off into a really a book of ideas. And I've just thrown about three questions at you.
Yeah.
But
let me take them one by one. I think familiar territory is always a comfort to a writer. So I find the north of England, where I'm from, fascinating. It's a very dramatic landscape. You know, it's kind of Wordsworth country. So you've got the whole romantic sense on one hand, and then you've got the kind of strange past battling with the future. So I've felt, I suppose Hardy did this to an extent as well. You know, you kind of pick a territory, and even if it's rural, you have human beings working in that arena, and so human dramas are going to arise out of those interactions. And I've always felt that even though the settings are sometimes quite remote and underpopulated in my fiction, there's enough going on. You can explore ideas of civilization, breakdown of civilization, you know, human emotional dramas, all the rest of that. But I think What's interesting with Daughters of the North is even though we're kind of casting ahead maybe 30, 40 years from now, and I think, you know, British science fiction and speculative fiction does this a lot. There's this idea at play that, you know, when catastrophe happens, everything is knocked back to the past. And so here's what you're left with, Day of the Triffids. You know, there's kind of this strange science fiction going on, but at the same time, everybody's going down the pub like they always have.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, in Daughters of the North, you do have a kind of modern... a kind of modern world, even if it's a broken world, and then you do have this kind of farming community which offsets that kind of bleak urban regimented existence. And it's the same kind of farming that you find in Haweswater, exactly right. You know, it's that farming that's been going on for centuries and it hasn't changed very much in that time.
There's one thing I wanted to ask you since we're on the subject of British dystopian novels. There are two books that this book reminded me of, and that was Rupert Thompson's Divided Kingdom, as well, because it has a similar reorganization in that, and this is a similar, absolutely crazy reorganization that is the linchpin of this story. But also, Anthony Burgess's The Wanting Seed. In fact, the thing that is really striking about this book, it's almost as if it's a response, because it has the same cyclical nature. In both books, and in your book, you have a character escaping this dystopia by essentially wandering across the English countryside. And this seemed very interesting to me. So, I mean, as a British dystopian novel writer, at least in this case, I mean, I would argue a lot more, I wanted to ask you about the wandering impulse. Is this something... Does the dystopian novel in Britain have to adhere to some sort of John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress kind of situation? Or why did you feel the need to have... your character wander off? And then also this cyclical nature that echoes the Burgess book.
I mean, it is a very interesting question, and I think it also relates to the idea in British fiction, especially of the tension between town and country. You know, so, strangely enough, the wandering right at the beginning of the book, where you see the main character's sister leaving the town and lighting out into the Cumbrian Mountains, it's kind of a leap of faith in search of this group of women on an old farm in the middle of nowhere on a mountain, is based on an experience that I had. There was very bad flooding in 2005 in the north of England, and my house was caught up in it, and the city where I was living then and still live was completely knocked out. So, I was desperate to get out of the city that morning after the storms and couldn't, because everything was flooded and the trees were down and the police were stopping people from leaving. And this very traumatic experience, I'm kind of wandering off on a tangent here, but this very traumatic experience really rattled me. And so at the beginning of the novel, you do have this woman desperately trying to leave this kind of terrible broken cityscape. And I suppose, you know, the country side in the book, in a way, although it's become wilderness and unofficial territory and it's not populated anymore, it is a place that offers kind of hope. I suppose, like the English countryside always has been a tonic in literature in a way, or a kind of stirring way of pitting the self against nature, like you find in the romantic tradition. So that's kind of at work in the book as well, the idea that, you know, the countryside offers something else. It's the place of actual recovery or hope or self-sufficiency. You know, and self-sufficiency is something that we're really starting to think about more in England, and I think probably here too.
Yeah, well, one would hope. Well, I mean, the thing is going back to this notion of Burgess's The Wanting Seed, I'm stuck on this because the hero in that book actually leaves his spouse and returns. And so that's why I was thinking it has a similar cyclical nature, and that's why I was curious as to how this was initiated. I mean, obviously, you've said in other interviews that Atwood is a big influence for you, and of course one could make also references to The Handmaid's Tale. But I'm curious more in particular about this wandering impulse that seems peculiarly British. And in fact, you know, the last book you wrote, The Electric Michelangelo, also had a wandering spirit, and it's almost as important to you as the environment within these books, and maybe you could talk about this.
It's interesting, actually, because I've never been asked this question in this way, but you're right. I mean, there's this definite trend, and I'm trying to kind of locate what it might be that's at work there. It could be that... you find a lot of people from the north of England traveling an awful lot. You know, they kind of want to get out of the north, and so they roam around the world and they come back again. But I don't know, maybe it's a sense of kind of searching for something, it's so hard to answer the question, actually, now I'm thinking about it. I mean, I haven't read the novels that you've volunteered, although they sound fantastic.
They're both great.
But I do think, again, if you look at science fiction, speculative fiction, dystopian fiction, whatever you want to call it, there are definitely conversations, you're right, there are definitely conversations going on between texts, whether it's kind of Aldous Huxley having a conversation with H.G. Wells, you know, in his work. There are definite kind of questions and answers going on. And I do think The Handmaid's Tale possibly raised some questions for me that I felt like, perhaps that I didn't want to answer with my own book, but I wanted to kind of think about what happens when the female spirit particularly is repressed, and what can be done about that. And what I wanted to create was a very proactive book, so the women actually take control and they organise themselves into a kind of militant force. And so in that respect, the books kind of differ, but I did have in mind these other fictions that have been written that are toying with this idea of regimes, what it means to be kind of liberated, what it means to be held to a very austere, brutal government, and how a person will kind of shake off these notions of what they should be doing for what they want to be doing.
Yeah, but there's also this idea. I was struck by something you just said, and I unfortunately just had a brain fart. But let me think. Well, about this idea of
What was I waffling about?
Yeah,
about,
no, about you were 2 minutes waffling. Ago. I mean, about having a conversation with other writers in this particular genre. I mean, what you said about Atwood was interesting because it seems to me that the rather crude metallic contraceptive device that is enforced by the authority was very much, to me, a kind of effort on your part to essentially outdo Atwood's sense of terror. I wanted to ask you about that.
No, it's not really trying to outdo anybody in terms of terror. I think I'm somebody who kind of seems to naturally write fiction that unsettles people, and I don't mean to do it on purpose. I think I possibly have quite a hard-boiled northern mentality in my work, and There are perceptions about female fiction and female writers, and I think I tend to kind of shock people sometimes because I do have this hard-boiled way of writing. So it wasn't trying to kind of outdo for shock. What I wanted to do with this book in particular was have a look at the problems that we have now, socially, politically, environmentally, and create a future scenario that really is a projection of those problems. And, you know, population control is very likely going to become an issue at some point in areas around the world. And so, for me, the idea of regulation of the population was going to be like an authentic way of setting up this future dystopia. Yeah. You know, the fact that if you have overcrowding, if you don't have enough food, if your government is involved with resource wars abroad, then the likeliest scenario is going to be that no more people added to the population. We really want to kind of monitor this. So for me, it was, I kind of did think very carefully about the scenario that I was setting up and what would be the likeliest kind of forms of control, government control, female control.
Yeah. I mean, this notion of contributing essentially, I mean, to me, this struck me as a novel of ideas. It reminded me to some degree of Scarlett Thomas's work. But this is a conversation I've been having with a lot of literary friends about this idea that if you are a woman, particularly in the States, I think more so than in the UK, if you contribute a novel of ideas, it is subject to greater scrutiny. I mean, I'm not sure if you saw our ridiculous castigation of Samantha Power for one thing she said. In fact, it originated in The Scotsman.
Yeah.
Well, Samantha Power, one of the great foreign policy intellectuals, said something about that Hillary Clinton is a monster, the kind of thing that we all casually say at one point or another.
Right.
Because of this, she was forced to resign from Obama's campaign.
Right.
And
this
kind of ties into this larger question I have of, have you experienced any obstacles as a woman writer who is literary, who does deal in this book with ideology and the notion of change, climate change, not just in an environmental sense, but also very much in a social and a political sense? You say that you have a tendency to really unsettle people, but if you were to go ahead and take the author photo and your name off the book and compare it in a sort of gender-blind scenario, I don't think it would be nearly as... people wouldn't be as fixated upon that. I mean, would you say that this would be something that you've experienced? Or?
I mean, I certainly think, as far as the kind of press and the media are concerned, they tend to respond differently to particularly young female writers.
Yeah.
It's a generalization to make, and I'm very lucky in that the publishers I have are very passionate about my work and will kind of back me up no matter the idea and the kind of style of the book. But I think male writers tend to have more freedom to range across genres and not necessarily be kind of scrutinized for that. The work will remain literary fiction if they're literary fiction writers. So you can kind of dabble in science fiction if you're a big name guy, and it might be reviewed in a science fiction capacity. But I don't think the scrutiny is kind of quite as extreme. I mean, I don't think I've come up against obstacles. I think
more perceptive obstacles, I suppose.
Yeah, you know, I suppose this is what's going on in kind of literature here and in the UK. This idea of presentation of the author and a real kind of curiosity about the author and who they are and do they conflate with their literature and you know, do they have an interesting backstory, and we're as fascinated with authors. In fact, we're more fascinated with authors than their work, I think now. So if you're I mean, I'm kind of like trying to tread carefully around this, really. Let me think about how to say this properly.
No worries.
There are huge marketing campaigns that go on now. And, you know, supposedly women are the biggest kind of buying group out there. So publishers like your work to appeal to women. Particularly, which means perhaps a softening of covers and a softening of titles, and the idea that the work is not necessarily going to be too radical or challenging. Again, these are generalizations, and it's possibly not fair to say this. We have some extraordinarily good female writers out there with very strong ideas, very strong styles, very idiosyncratic, but you wouldn't know that by looking at the books on the shelves, I don't think. So I think covers, it's an interesting area. I mean, we seem to kind of be favouring these generic covers at the minute, and there are no real strong kind of commissioned artworks anymore, I don't think, which I think is a shame, because, well, I'm not sure who buys a book by the cover. I'm sure people do, but I like to be interested in it visually when I go into bookshop as well, and I don't just want to see pastel colours everywhere. I don't. So this only partly answers your question, really. I mean, it's very odd. I think the whole reviewing and critical process is a strange field in itself. Some of the comments that particularly Daughters of the North has received have been unusually nitpicky. And almost grudging. It's like some of the reviewers are upset that I'm kind of dealing with military issues, for example, Second World War rifles, and like to think that I haven't done my research, which is an absolute untruth. I am somebody who researches to a fault. But of course, we'll concede that there's some nice landscape writing in there.
Yeah.
You know, she's a lovely landscape writer.
This notion of research or this notion of authenticity is interesting to me, because I viewed this particular story, since this is a testimony, essentially, since it's told, unlike your other two books, in the first person. Mm-hmm. Well, now we get into interesting issues of the unreliable narrator. So what we are seeing here is not necessarily entirely the truth.
No.
In fact, one could also view this book hypothetically as a grand kind of concoction of maybe someone... Okay, here's a rather elaborate and out there theory. But one can view this book, yes, it's set in the future, but what Sister is bringing to this particular book and telling her story like this is possibly a level of invention, of a coping, if you will, of real environmental problems that she has to escape into a fantasy for. I mean, she does, to a large degree, escape into a certain idealized fantasy, and she both adheres to this, but also is hesitant to this. I mean, the final line of the book is really an amazing declaration.
It's indoctrination, basically. Yeah. She's become very radicalized by the woman who's the leader of this group of women, who is an incredibly charismatic, strong personality, and basically takes the kind of feeling that Sister has and the fire in her belly, which has not been kind of focused in any particular way.
Uh-oh. Fire alarm.
Should we stop, or...?
Okay, so in light of the fire alarms, so this idea then that the book can't be read as a sort of straight way, I wanted to ask you, actually, while we're on this subject, about the dialogue in this book, which is, unlike your other two books, it's embedded within the paragraphs. And the previous dialogue you had in your other two books had this transcripted vernacular quality to it that I found very interesting, but now that you've put the dialogue within the paragraphs, it has an altogether different feel, and in fact, has this authenticity. This question of authenticity in narrative through dialogue, how much has this been a factor for you? I mean, have you had to struggle with some of your dialogue over the books, or...?
Yeah, dialogue's not something that I've found particularly easy, so I've always been kind of cautious with it. And I think first two novels, it's used quite sparingly, and you're right, the kind of dialogue is transcripted, and so it takes on a kind of almost like a script form, you know, the dash and then the dialogue. And in a way, it's slightly mannered too. In Horsewater, it's mannered because it's written phonetically in the kind of dialect of the region. Electric Michelangelo, it's kind of mannered because the book's mannered. It has a very lyrical feel, and so I kind of gave the dialogue of those two books over to the kind of spirit and the style of the books themselves. Daughters of the North, on the other hand.
You could say...
Cahal and Army, on the other hand.
We could just
flip. They're interchangeable, hey.
Flip-flop here.
Yeah. You're right. I mean, and I did have this conversation with my copy editor. He said, do you want to sync the dialogue into the paragraphs? And I said, yes, because, you know, the story does belong to Sister. It's entirely her statement while in custody. And it felt like the story had more flow. It felt like it was a more natural way of doing things. And the novel is a kind of exercise for me in speed and talk and kind of pace. The other novels have been slower, more descriptive. This is kind of hopefully it's a page turner. It's more of a thrill, and it's fast paced. And so to kind of keep the dialogue active within the story in that way, to sync it more, seemed to allow for the kind of rate of reading, maybe.
You wanted to write a page-turner for this?
I did, yeah,
More than the other books, which are more leisurely.
Yeah, I think so. And it felt like such an urgent book. It was written quite quickly. The first draft was written quite quickly. I mean, it's a fairly short novel. And the issues are urgent. You know, the issues are urgent. Environmental issues are kind of coming around. The projections are arriving now. We're getting floods and extreme weather and warming and all this. And the idea of kind of terrorism and what will kind of convert people to extremism or extreme beliefs. These are all issues that are sitting with us now. And so, yeah, the book felt like it was, it felt, even though it's small, it felt like there was a really big stone rolling behind me and I was having to move quickly with it.
Yeah. But I mean, do you think, obviously you're going to have to abdicate some of your literary chops if you are writing a page turner, if the emphasis now becomes on keeping the narrative train rolling, so to speak? And I'm wondering how much difficulty you had it's a shorter book than the other two, although Hawswater is pretty svelte in its own way.
Lean.
Yes.
Lean like a northern dog.
But I mean, obviously the spirit of urgency seemed to grab you, but it also seems to me, in light of the other concerns that we were raising earlier when we were talking shop about the publishing industry, that were these concerns on your part? I mean, to some degree, if you have a particular voice, and I would say that you do, why should one worry about this idea of writing a page turner?
I mean, I think for your own interest, you kind of want to achieve different things with different books. And this was a book that I wanted it to be a journey. You know, this woman goes on a journey, and so I wanted the reader to go on that journey as well and be transported and kind of move at the speed that she moves at. And I think, you know, I do think it has the same kind of descriptive timbre to it, the same notes that the first two novels have, but I've just had to be more selective. So instead of choosing three words, as I did in Electric Michelangelo, to describe something, I'm picking one, but I'm trying to pick the absolute right word for that sentence. So it, for me, it felt like quite a discipline as well. I was required to kind of ditch some of the, should we say flaccid? I don't know if flaccid's the right word. That sounds like a terrible word. I was having to hone my skills as a writer. Mm. You know, and I think in many ways, this is the best book I've written. Mm. I don't think it compromises on style or description or kind of literary intellect, is that the right word? Questioning, maybe, or thought. But what it does do is, I hope, again, it provides a rattling tale, a real rattling tale.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm wondering, too, if this was an effort on your part to work within limitations, because I've noticed over the course of the three books that there has been an increasing effort on your part to confine the environments. The hotel room at the beginning of the Electric Michelangelo, the dog box in this. This seems to me quite interesting because we're gradually seeing the area in which the character can wander actually decrease in its size. And likewise, it seems that we're seeing this also with the choices you have available as a writer to write these particular sentences. So I wanted to ask you about this.
It's interesting. I mean, maybe it's also an exercise in kind of character interiority. So, you know, the kind of confinement closes in. And you're right, the spaces do kind of close in. And the borders are shut down around the kind of the setting of the novel. But I suppose the novel's Well, I've switched to the first person for the third novel, so we're really kind of climbing inside the head of the character, which I did not do for the first two novels because they're in the third person. So you're right, it's a kind of I suppose the setting maybe does mirror the sort of the exercise in character interiority and emotion, kind of emotion and thought and motivation. But you know, I suppose with Daughters of the North, the setting is so remote and it's so closed. It's this old fortified farm, and really, I suppose the kind of rule of Jackie Nixon, who's this character up there, is also it becomes as brutal as the rule down in the town. I mean, Sister basically switches one form of control for another, even though she feels that she's selected the kind of regime that she wants to belong to.
Yeah. Speaking of which, was Richard Milhouse in mind with that name?
No.
I was curious.
No, I mean, well, Jackie Nixon, you mean?
Yeah.
No, Nixon is it's an old border name. So I'm from the, you know, England Scotland borders, and it's a classic name. So, you know, Jackie.
It takes on additional resonance.
It does. You know, and there are, I mean, again, you see this in kind of Brave New World. The names in Brave New World have obviously, I mean, much more so than in Daughters of the North. They've been chosen and they've been amalgamated, and they're, you know, they're names of the time that Huxley was kind of commenting on. The Prime Minister of the kind of brutal government in Daughters of the North is called Powell, and I don't know if you remember a politician in the UK called Enoch Powell.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are certain, I mean, you have to be a little bit careful when you're doing it, because what you want is that kind of sense of resonance, like you say, you know, an echo of something, so that you can kind of feel that that it relates somehow. There's a web out there into real life and real history, but at the same time things become bifurcated, they slip, they're out of kilter, you know, they're familiar but they're not familiar at the same time.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to ask you about, a common motif throughout your books, are characters who have these reddened faces. We see it with the driver at the beginning of this book. We see it with one of the characters, I believe the wiry farmer in Oswater.
His father.
And I was curious about this fixation of yours. I mean, is this just something you saw frequently growing up in Cumbria?
Yeah. That red face, kind of outdoor farming look, you know, straw-colored hair, red face from being outside, labouring. You know, kind of broken capillaries, all that stuff. It's and also alcohol and booze, and I do think it has that kind of very English sense to it, you know. I'm making all English gentlemen of a certain age sound very unattractive here, but yes, it's there's a kind of local look. You know, not so much anymore, because we're a very mixed country, which is great, you know. So the kind of Viking look of the North is kind of changing. But you do still get this kind of particular... I mean, you get it across the world, don't you? There's a particular look to certain characters in certain areas, and I'm always fascinated by that.
Not just the look, though, but also the language is also colloquial English. I mean, like in Hawswater, the thing that's very pleasant about that book is seeing navvies used frequently, because we don't have a name for that in America here. So, and there are throughout, in fact, in Daughters of the North, there's a number of them I can't immediately bring to mind, but I'm struck by many of the colloquial Northern English vernacular that occupies your work.
I mean, I love these words. I really do. They've got such kind of power to them. They're so... and some of them come from Celtic, some are kind of Anglo-Saxon, so there are very strong words in there, like foss, you know, bield. A lot of the time they're kind of topographical, so it's a kind of a depression in a hill or something like that. But I heard this when I was growing up, you know. Cumbria had its own language. It was one of the Celtic languages, and it's pretty much gone now, but you would hear these old farmers talking, and you know, half their sentences would be in this old kind of dialect, this old language. So I didn't understand it, you know, even though I'm from the area, I didn't understand all the words. I can count to five, you know, yan, tan, tether, mether, pip, it's great, you know, but I can't get much further than that. So I would hear these words, and they're so powerful, they sound kind of biblical, they sound so old, they sound so powerful, and with the accent on top of it, they're kind of Carhullen. Carhullen is the name of a farm in the valley where I'm from. So I took that name and I used it because it's such a strong word, and I love the English language. I think we forget how beautiful and savage and romantic and kind of rich and derivative from so many other languages it is. We think of Italian as being a beautiful language. We think of Welsh as being a beautiful language, and it is. But the English language is amazing. Our words are amazing. The heritage is amazing. And I just think it's a shame to kind of forget that.
Yeah.
Well, in this book, you shorten Penrith to Rith, thereby taking away this wonderful word. And again, the thing that strikes me about many of these words that you use is that they're often two syllables. And to me, it's an absolute shame to take a wonderful word like Penrith and just slice that prefix off of it so it becomes meaningless, you know?
Yeah, and I suppose that was done because, again, it's this idea of you set something in the future, you want to kind of pull the rug out from what you know and make things slightly unusual but recognisable. So Penrith is the town where, it was my hometown, I went to school there, but you turn it into Rith and all of a sudden it becomes a new place. The city of Carlisle, which is where I live now, which is on the England-Scotland border, the great border city, is called the Solway City because it sits on the Solway in the novel. And I wanted that sense of strangeness. It's a little bit of a nod maybe to kind of American fiction. I'm a big fan of a lot of American fiction, and I like the Solway City. It gave it that kind of American feel. And also the novel kind of discusses the relationship between the UK and America a little bit, and some of the tensions that we have now and some of the kind of allegiances that we have. So I think, just these little twists of the dial to make things different, but...
But in this case, the pen is not mightier than the sword, and that's rather depressing, I would say.
I think that's true. And I do think the book also contains a sense of maybe sadness, longing, nostalgia, which of course is present in the first two novels as well, and I don't know whether it's just a spirit of the North, again, that creeps into the work. But this idea of whether it's the kind of changing weather, so that we don't have our traditional weather systems anymore. We don't have snow anymore, really. We may well get too much snow, you know, in the next 20 or 30 or 50 years, or we may become semi-tropical. We don't really know yet. But I think there is a sense of kind of what is being taken away and history being kind of removed, and this book does contain that. It contains it in a political small P sense, and in this sense, which I think is very personal to me, coming from an old community that is pretty much now been stripped of its history. There's almost nobody farming sheep anymore.
Yeah.
You know, in the valley where I'm from, it contains second homes. The school where my junior school shut down 2 years ago, it had been open for 400 fucking years, and it's just shut down.
Yeah.
That's such a shame. Yeah. There are no kids in the valley to go to the school
anymore.
That's
fantastic, because there's a school in Hawes.
I just cursed, I apologize.
Oh, there's a podcast, you can say whatever.
Oh, right, okay, I'm sorry about that.
No, you don't have to apologize.
But 400 years.
Yeah.
The school had been open for 400 years, and it's shut, and it's tragic, you know. And I suppose the book is maybe slightly anti centralization, you know, anti kind of grand supermarket, very pro small regional idiosyncratic outlets and traditions, because that's what I was brought up with, and I love that. I do love that.
It's interesting you bring up the school in light of the school being disassembled and relocated in the first book too.
Yeah,
and
that actually happened. The school in Mardale, which is the valley that was flooded to create the reservoir of Haweswater, was an anonymous donator. They never found out who it was, provided some money so that the school could be taken apart brick by brick and rebuilt in the next valley over where it would be safe, and it still stands today. It's only a tiny little school, but not the school that I went to, but only about 2 miles away, which I think is great. Lost my train of thought.
Oh, no, that's perfectly okay. I actually wanted to ask you about one glaring symbol to me. I'm sure you're familiar with the Ursula K. Le Guin essay, The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas. It's... basically posits this utopia that comes at the price of a little girl who sits in a shed in squalor, and that can you live with this idea of a utopia knowing that little girl is in abject poverty and suffering? And this seemed very interesting to me because the whole dog thing, the dog tank, was very evocative of this very specific symbol, but now you're saying that you aren't aware of this.
No, I'm not. I'm sounding really terribly underread.
Oh,
I must apologize to everybody. I have really read lots of fiction, just
I
not, the, not the books that you're
quoting. Sure. You're using all these great words in your work, and there's this lovely, and you're more than an environmental describer.
My reading list is very long. Let's put it that way. You know, really, the dog box, people keep coming back to the dog box because it's such a horrible creation. But I have a friend who was in the US military, and some of the kind of training he underwent was very, very similar. So he shared some of his experiences with me, and the dog box is based on kind of training that he was put through. Uh-huh. And it really was a tiny little shed with a stool that wouldn't kind of sit still, and it's kind of used as a device to sort of toughen people up. So I mean, this is one of the big shocks to the book. You know, the character of Sister arrives at this community, and she thinks that they're going to welcome her with open arms and congratulate her for getting out of the town and for being strong and willful. And she arrives, and they tackle her on the fell, and they march her, you know, at gunpoint into the farm, and they sling her into this. It's basically a torture device.
Yeah.
And so immediately, you know, you kind of think, well, everything is not as it seems. And how do you write about utopias?
Yeah.
You can't write about utopias somehow. You can't write about them because they never exist. They can't exist. They can only ever exist in the abstract. They always seem to go wrong. Things always break down. So the great noble movements, you know, look at the feminist movement in the UK. Brilliant ideas kind of fell apart. You know, people started to squabble and try and define how things should be and what people should believe. And so utopia is endlessly fascinating from a kind of very commercial level, in that we all love to sit and watch Big Brother. I know you guys have that over here now as well. And watch,
I don't like to. But
yeah. Watch people in a kind of enclosed, you know, enclosed situation, just watch how they operate. To these ideas of, you know, kind of Shangri-Las, I suppose, these communities of the mind that are going to do things better, but somehow pitted against everything that's crappy out there. They don't work. But it is very interesting, you know, the question posed about whether or not a utopia can exist or will work in the face of squalor elsewhere or failure elsewhere.
Yeah.
Well, but this is interesting to me because Carhollen is essentially a micro-utopia in a macro-dystopia. And the thing that is interesting about this book is that the choices you have are to surrender to one or the other. You either have to submit and have your will taken away, your ability to resist whittled down, your ability to question destroyed, or you go into a seeming utopia that is going to offer you this perceived enlightenment, and in fact, no, it's just as bad as the other system.
That's right.
And but
humans are always in charge, so whenever there are a human being in charge, things are going to become personal and trying to find the right word again. Well, the motivation is, there's going to be motivation underlying everything, you know.
But I must, at the risk of adding another nitpick to the realms of nitpicks. I mean, okay, I get where you're going with this, and I think it's a very interesting ideological, and it's very subtextual in this book. It's this very interesting ideological debate. But I would like to think that if the world, whether in the UK or here in the States, were to shift to this more authoritarian system.
You mean when?
Well.
You don't think we're going to be fighting for water and food at some point?
Oh, I think that we'll definitely be.
We're already fighting for oil.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But, I don't know. Call me an optimist. I'm not in that James Howard Kunstler's school although he raises some valid points. Well, you know, it could happen. I believe that overnight the States and the UK could shift to nuclear energy. That's a whole other matter. But okay.
We already are.
But you don't think, you pose in this book, there are very few objectors to this. People are completely complacent to this new system, one way or the other. And I found this to be, somewhat suspect.
Yeah, you're supposed to. You're supposed to be annoyed by it.
Yeah.
Because I don't truly believe people are as apathetic as that. I do think there's a sense of apathy.
Yeah.
Well, strangely, I mean, there's a kind of paradox there, isn't there? That there is a sort of sense of apathy, but also at the same time, people are protesting more than they ever have. They protested against the Iraq War, although it didn't seem to matter. So many people turned out on the streets of London, and it didn't seem to matter.
Here too.
So, but in terms of, I suppose, the environment, what could be done, what needs to be done, whether or not we believe the projections and the statistics, and you know, I know there are a large number of kind of climate change deniers who still are adamant that it's not going to happen. It is not happening. There are explanations other than the ones that are being given to us by the scientists and the geologists and the climate experts. I still think there is a kind of apathy surrounding that situation. Nobody's getting out of their 4x4. Nobody's. I know that commercials now in this country are very kind of, we're green middlemen and we can help you live a greener life. You know, I've noticed this just coming back in the last 6 months. There's a lot of this stuff on the TV. But the changes aren't really being made, you know.
Yeah.
If people are not flying, it's because they can't afford to. It's not because they think they shouldn't be flying,
yeah.
I believe. I don't think we've reached that wide-scale, active involvement with the problem. So yes, there is apathy in the book, and it wouldn't exist to that degree, but it's amplified to manipulate you as a reader into being very, very annoyed.
So really...
It's a book that manipulates, and it's supposed to. It's supposed to... annoy and manipulate and make you think and make you kind of deny and make you object, basically.
But there is a question of verisimilitude here, because I can't fathom any future, no matter how authoritarian, not having any kind of objections.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, human beings are just not made that way, mm-hmm. particularly when you're dealing with these extraordinary scenarios with the contraception
yeah.
that we were talking about earlier. I mean, even if people were to be shot on the streets, there would still be some kind of objection.
Mm-hmm.
It may be completely thrown underneath the media, because the media does often do that, but nevertheless, it does happen. People mm-hmm. continue to object, and that's one of the...
And this is a country that's armed.
Yeah.
We're not, you know. We will take to the streets, but I mean, again, it depends. The outcome is kind of dependent on the powers that be. Look at the way Thatcher dealt with the miners.
Yeah. I know.
It's not that there wasn't a protest there. It's not that there wasn't a huge, huge, mass organized protest. It did no good, you know. But you're right. There would be objections, and I suppose the argument would be it's the women at the farm that are objecting. Now, they might be doing it in a troublesome, difficult, controversial way, because they eventually turn against their own government.
Yeah.
And again, there are echoes in Jackie Nixon. She's a leader who, I'm saying hopefully a lot. This is what my intention as a writer. Jackie Nixon is set up to seesaw between being thrilling and heroic and a modern day Boadicea, and or kind of a terrorist paramilitary leader in the worst possible sense. I mean, she begins by posing a choice for the women at the farm. You can either fight with me, or I'll let you go, and I'll put you safely back into the safety zones. And she shoots one of the women
yeah.
At the farm who won't fight and who's causing trouble. And there's a question mark over whether the women that she's supposed to be transplanting back into the official zones who don't want to fight with her actually make it there. There is a suggestion in the novel that she's dealt with them as she has dealt with the one woman who objected strongly. You know, and this kind of thing is sort of based on paramilitary research. Like, look at the IRA, structured incredibly, no matter what you think of the IRA, as an organisation they were structured in a very professional sense, and this is how they dealt with people who posed a threat to them as an organisation.
Yeah.
They got rid of their own men who were going to create problems for them. And Jackie Nixon is a character who is capable of doing this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, touching upon this particular issue of whether you're manipulating the reader or not filling in these shades of gray, or allowing the reader to sort of fill in those shades of gray by questioning this idea of this dichotomy, essentially, I want to actually read you a description of Megan, who is a very interesting figure. You write, "If she had been created on a philosophical specimen dish, then her genetic beliefs had been altered to make her more resilient and assured of herself, more companionable to her own kind. She had not been exposed to a world of inferiority or cattiness, nor male dominance. She was, in a way, an idealized female. Immediately before this, you have Sister observing of her, 'When I told her about the recovery efforts, she described the government as temporary and misguided. I knew they were not her words, and I was sure how much she comprehended the system in place, or whether she realized she still felt under its power. She talked about the authority as if it were bad weather," weather again, "something that had to be taken into account and could be endured until it passed." Now, this to me is striking on a number of levels. One, this association of how one lives with climate. But again, if we go back to this quibble, I'm wondering, yes, if you were to exist in one way or another, then certainly the manner in which you were raised, the manner in which you grew up would certainly change. But I just don't think that you would have one choice or another given this particular situation. I don't really... I'm wondering why you're associating this with climate change, and I'm wondering why you're not giving... I mean, going back to this question of manipulation, I mean... okay, you've got me here thinking about this, but I'm saying to myself, well, you know, she wrote this really interesting, thoughtful book, and yet that gray area is not accounted for. Mm. So I wanted to ask you about the manipulation in light of this passage.
Hmm. It's interesting. I mean, this is very much Sister's perception of Megan when she gets up to the farm and she meets this girl who's kind of wild but has read all this literature that exists up at the farm. She seems, on the one hand, kind of free-thinking. She seems she seems kind of very sororal. She's great towards the other women. She is also... She's 14 years old and she fights in Jackie's army. So she's basically... She's been deeply, deeply manipulated by Jackie. And you know, these images of kind of kid soldiers in Africa, you know, 8-year-olds with guns.
Yeah.
Horrible, you know. So at the end of this novel, you get a 14-year-old girl with a gun, you know.
Yeah.
And it is terrible. I mean, there are kind of lots of different levels to the question. In terms of... I mean, every book is an artifice, isn't it? There's a conceit to everything and a confection to everything that you write, and it exists in one way, and it's nice to try and keep it as open as possible, open to interpretation. There is a grand manipulation to the whole book in that it's a statement, and there are missing sections to the statement.
Yes, which we haven't touched upon.
And again, the kind of jump cut at the end of the novel has annoyed people. What I want people to do is think about why that cut's been made. The two most all the violence happens off stage, more or less, in this book. So the cuts in the book are the kind of violent scenes, and it exists as a document. And I wanted people to think about the idea of women and violence, because this is a cultural issue that we face as well.
Yeah.
Women are becoming increasingly more violent. Perhaps they always have been this violent. Perhaps they now feel that they have the freedom to be this violent. But these cuts have been made in the novel for a reason, and it places the focus elsewhere, and it asks you to think about why these sections are missing, who has taken them out, whether they ever existed at all, whether Sister gave this information over. So the whole novel is a kind of big manipulation, in a sense, that you're presented only some of the evidence, as it were.
But I believe that a novel can be both artifice and relatively sincere. Obviously, as we're talking about this, you do have very sincere and specific thoughts about the issues within this book. I mean, I thought that the data was missing, largely because, going back to this question of choosing one or the other, well, it's not about a sweeping ideology, whether it comes from government, whether it comes from sort of some sort of utopia. Mm-hmm. It's about how one individually divagates through a terrible terrain, or even just any environment whatsoever, and that the idea of having a complete story of how one person changes, and juxtaposing this and inverting this against the idea of an ideology that offers the complete panacea for this mm-hmm. this to me is the more interesting question, and I don't think it really matters so much why the data has been elided. Mm-hmm. I think what matters most of all is that it has been elided, and that it needs to and that we need to start thinking more in terms of really, what is our own individual choice? And maybe I've just answered the question that I posed to you, this idea of the shades of grey,
yes,
you know?
Exactly. The focus is definitely on Sister and the relationship with Jackie and her kind of personal journey and what turns her and what makes her and to keep the focus. I mean, if I was going to write that last scene at the end of the book that's missing, it would have turned the book into something completely other. Difficult choices. There are very difficult choices when you're writing, always. And this was one of them. Ask me the question again.
Well, the question was this idea of data missing versus individual choice, and how one subscribes to an ideology or one thinks and takes various things of the world that they live in so as to find their own particular way of effectively living with the environment. That's sort of the question here.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, to what extent was I thinking about this while I was writing it? I don't know. I mean, I'm a fairly intuitive writer, so...
But when did you decide to drop the information? Maybe we can get back at this question.
It was never written. It was never written. Those sections were never written. They were thought about, but they were never written. And, well, I mean, why don't we see... You know, why is there ever a jump cut, I suppose? Why don't you see Conrad's bomb? You don't actually see the bomb. You see the aftermath of the bomb. And in Cahullan, in Daughters of the North, you see the aftermath of the war. And I suppose it does strip away the idea of an individual's choice to do that, and it kind of it preserves this this kind of linear journey that Sister is on, whether or not she's made that choice herself. I don't know whether I'm sure. I don't know whether the reader can be sure. But she's kind of, once she's in it, and there's no other possible way for her to move. And she gives herself over wholeheartedly to it. And as you mentioned before, the kind of end statement of the novel, it sounds like something that you would find a government kind of issuing, a statement issued by a government during a war. I mean, it's so official that it becomes bloodless in a way, even though it's incredibly bloody. And the end of the novel is bloody.
Yeah.
But it becomes so kind of dehumanized that there is a sense of the kind of human choice has been abstracted from it. You know, we shot the doctors at the clinic, and we got rid of all the carbon records. And it's as ruthless as the kind of recovery process that the government of Britain in the novel has implemented.
Yeah.
So there's a circle in there, I suppose. Again, this is waffle, isn't it?
You it is waffling, you are getting a little bit in your obliqueness. There's some cemented. Which is not to say I think that ambiguity is a very good thing. I'm just trying to sort of get your take on this relationship. But I think I'll shift gears a little bit and ask you about one particular aspect in both this and Hawswater. I see, again, a lot of similarities between the two. You introduce Laurie, and you describe a deep groove above her nose where her brow pinched in. It was a mark of a perpetual frown, an expression that seemed to be worn, perhaps even when she did not mean for it to be present. And this reminded me very much of the star that was on Janet Lightburn's forehead.
Yeah.
Taking things
Which
further.
Is also, incidentally, on Sarah Hall's forehead.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's up in my scalp.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, this idea of flesh seems to be a big thing, and it's also explored to a large degree in The Electric Michelangelo, and I wanted to ask you about
this. It's always the females. It's always the female body, because and I suppose there's a slight railing against the idea of female perfection, which we are still so obsessed with, and... Mm-hmm. There's lots of debate about new feminism in the UK at the minute, and what is new feminism, and whether you can be, you know, whether you can go around with no underwear being photographed by the press and still be an entirely liberated woman. And so these kind of questions of female freedom and female choice and are there, but it always relates to the female body. We cannot get away from the female body. It's like women have been given the vote and they can now work and they can choose to have children or not, but they are still spending tons and tons of money on anti-wrinkle cream, and this idea of beauty and classical beauty and perfection hasn't gone away. So, and I find it very, very uninteresting. It's boring to me. And so what I want my female characters to look like are females that have lived and that have broken bodies. You know, Rita Parks is described as having a broken stomach after childbirth in Electric Michelangelo. And Grace, the circus performer, is described as having kind of beautiful orange peel dappling on the back of her legs. It's cellulite. It's not a problem that women have.
Yeah.
The problem is women are not using their brains. That's the problem, you know? So yes, there are scars, there are kind of signs of work and industry, and that's very interesting to me because, again, I come from an area where the women have to work in very, very hard jobs. They're up on the mountains farming, or they were when I was a kid. And I think it's great, and I think it's gorgeous. I love the idea of imperfection in the human body. It's interesting. It denotes character, it denotes integrity of work, integrity of spirit. Very, very rarely will you find a classically beautiful character in my novels, particularly female.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, too, because in light of the rather dilapidated environments in your books, there is a certain beauty to the way that you describe this particular grit that is likewise there. And I'm wondering if really this may be one of your main fictive devices, one of the things you wish to contribute with your work, this idea that there is beauty in ugliness in all this, and why are we casting judgment upon this when we can see within the ugliness, within the misfits, within the cockeyed mountains or whatnot, you can see wonder.
Yeah, no, I think that's very accurate, actually. I think it's a great description of what I hope to do in the work. And I think Electric Michelangelo particularly, and tattooing lends itself to this idea beautifully, because in Western tattooing, the kind of symbolism, the symbols historically break down into good and bad, you know, beauty and ugliness. And these are the kind of, you know, these are the kind of bipolar regions of the human being, really. But they're so similar. They're so different and they're so similar. And I don't know. Yeah, I would like to think there's a contribution in the work, and the contribution is these characters are interesting. They're not interesting because of what they look like. They're interesting because of what they're doing. These women are having to survive up on a mountain. And there's a woman with a deep groove in her forehead because her work is very hard, and she's old. And people get lines in their foreheads when they're old. They don't have to have them shot full of Botox. Yeah. Botox. They don't.
And the shaved heads as well.
And the I mean, again, this is like a military thing, isn't it? It's a kind of, if you're going to become a soldier, then you're going to follow the kind of soldier's creed, and that involves turning your body into something that it was not before, an extreme anatomy. There's a point in Daughters of the North where Sister, towards the end of the training that she goes through, there's a tradition at the farm of Carhullen. They're allowed a bath once a year on their birthday as a special treat in the main house. Other than that, they're kind of showering under rain tanks outside and it's freezing cold. So she goes for her bath on her birthday. I think it's her 33rd birthday. And there's one mirror in Carhullen as well. The only mirror that exists is the one in the bathroom in the main farmhouse. And she catches sight of her body after all this training and is so thrilled by it. You know, it's this sense of... and she describes it as the anatomy of a fanatic, you know. And I suppose because of the harsh landscape I was brought up in, because of the kind of hardy way that people have to exist, I do think... I always have the sense of kind of resilience of spirit going hand in hand with kind of resilience of body. I think it's Mrs. DeBose, isn't it, in To Kill a Mockingbird, the old lady she's in utter pain. She's a terrible, wonderful character. And I read this book when I was younger, and what's the line? You'll probably be able to quote it better than me, but she says she doesn't want to be beholden to anything, so she won't take any painkillers, she won't take any morphine.
That's right,
she just kind of... And I read this as a kid, and this line so struck me because I could see this in these old, broken, strong women and men that were in the valley where I was from, and to me that just seemed so right. It seemed so authentic. And
well, while we're on the subject of Mockingbird, it also seems to me that you're evoking... Remember the character who has the purported alcohol in the bag, but actually it's Coca-Cola, and Scout drinks it or her brother drinks it and gets this tingly feeling. And there are a lot of similar bags throughout your book with this. I mean, the bags that contain other things. And I it seems to me that maybe subconsciously Mockingbird may be a huge...
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's an interesting question, isn't it, what you pick up from your kind of childhood literature and what stays with you. In the UK, I've been interviewed quite a lot about the book Zed for Zachariah by Robert C. O'Brien, which for me was another big... it was a kind of another big reading experience for me. It was the book that that really thrilled me and terrified me and made me angry as a reader, as an independent private experience. That was the book that did it for me. And strangely enough, it's a dystopian fiction set in a rural landscape that's kind of hermetic, and things are going on in their own way, in their own traditional way, and there's a gender struggle going on there too. And I do, yeah, I read through my own work, and there are notes that I can hear in there that are, whether or not it's a kind of conscious nod to the kind of art forms that I've loved as a kid. Somebody just interviewed me about Daughters and asked whether there was a relationship between the book and Alien, you know, the Ripley character in the Alien films. And there is, and it was so strange to me because I don't think anywhere in the novel you could directly say that there's an influence, but there must be because the person honed in on this character, and I love the Ripley character in the Alien films. And there's one particular scene in the second film where, do you remember this? She climbs into the kind of hydraulic whatever it is, lifting machine.
Exactly.
And as a female viewer, you see a scene like this, which is rare in cinema, and you see it, and it's so thrilling, it's so exciting, it fills you up with fire. And that's what I try and create. I try and create these moments in the novels where, not just as a female reader, but as a reader, you might borrow the fire that's going on in the character at the time And there's a little bit in the book where sister's in the dog box. They've thrown her in the dog box when she arrives at the farm. She's not being given water or food. She's kind of going slowly mad. She's injured. She's exhausted. And she starts hallucinating. And she imagines that she's inside a metal woman. I don't know if you remember this, but she imagines she's inside a metal woman and she's being carried up the mountain in this metal woman.
Yeah.
And that it's a nod to Alien, it is, you know. I think it's a lovely thing to do. It's, you know, it's, well, why not? Why not tip your hat to the kind of the things of art that really speak to you and move you?
Gotcha. Well, there's one last question I want to ask you, and this is pertaining to relationships. In this book, Sister and Shruti, they sleep together rather suddenly, but we don't really have much of a build-up. But this is also the case with Jack Liggett and Janet in Hawswater. This tendency to rush into this sexuality is intriguing to me, because I look at this and I think you write sex very well, but I also have I'm also wondering, well, what, where did the attraction come from? Because it's so sudden to me that I must ask you about this, or maybe you just want to get to the naughty bits. I don't know.
We don't do foreplay in the UK, you know. Who knows how that's done? What do? You have a drink and talk?
Yeah, exactly.
You hold hands? I don't know. No, you're right. You're right. Actually, it is perceptive. There are very short kind of periods of courtship. I think it does exist in Hawswater, but I think it exists in that kind of combative, confrontational note that there is between Jack Liggett, who arrives in the valley to tell the villagers that they're about to lose their homes because a reservoir's coming, and Janet Lightburn, the daughter of one of the families, who hates this man. She hates this man, but he's also attractive.
Your typical and, John Ford, Marino Hera
right,
kind of thing.
It's that kind of, it's the kind of loathing, the loathing, the high passion that can, and I think this is true, I think a high passion like that can tip over into a kind of sexual passion or something. So the sexual relationship in Hawswater is it's quite violent, I suppose. It's it is quick, it's kind of opportunistic, but at the same time there is the sense that this valley's shutting down. There's basically a year left in the life of this valley as it existed. And so I think it goes to that as well. In Daughters of the North, that scene is interesting. The women at the farm go and visit a satellite group of male kind of semi-farmers. They're living nearby and they're farming turnips, basically, and they're kind of a little bit beholding to Cahullan Farm. And the women go and visit them and for sexual gratification, or some of them have long-standing relationships with these men. But I was interested in... I'm interested in the notion of female sexuality and what it is and what it isn't, because again, there's this idea that women are supposed to be more romantic and they're supposed to enjoy certain aspects of their sexuality and sex, which I think is kind of a narrow, corseted perspective on women and sex. So, you know, you turn on, you watch pornography, women aren't supposed to like pornography, but actually they really do like some kind of pornography if it's geared towards them, and even if it's not. So I think there is that idea of arousal by proxy. Sister arrives at the village. She hears the kind of congress going on in some of the outbuildings, and it turns her on. And so she kind of reaches out to the woman who's next to her. But I also think, I suppose what the novels do is they explore sexuality alongside whatever other kind of emotional landscape there is going on. So at that point, Sister feels so kind of free in a way, but also because she hasn't felt anything for her husband for a number of years, and the kind of humiliation of being forced to wear a contraceptive device and have that investigated by the monitors whenever they feel like they need to investigate it. I mean, it's a very humiliating ritual to go through. So I think at that point she's feeling kind of freedom. She's also that there's proximity to sex going on and she can hear it. And I do like to, I suppose, investigate the idea of what turns women on and how sex is a kind of very difficult, kind of multifaceted thing for women and men, but I think we've traditionally thought of it as being slightly more reserved, contained, conditioned when it comes to women.
I totally get where you're coming from here, no pun intended, but I would argue that this is the same dichotomy that we were discussing earlier about choosing between the government and the ideology. I would say, well, no, you can in fact have romance, and it doesn't have to be cosseted. It can actually be respectful. And I'm saying here again to you that maybe there's an opportunity here to explore these shades of gray. It doesn't have to be black or white. That's what I'm sort of saying. That's why these particular incidents strike me. I mean, I find them vivid, but I would argue with you that there is even more you could explore. explore by delving and inverting and mishmashing and causing all manner of amalgams to be there in the text.
It's true. It's true. I think on a personal level, I have to be a little bit careful because I do have a tendency to think on the page. Mm-hmm. So some of the criticisms that came along for Electric Michelangelo was there's a lot of exposition, there's a lot of kind of thinking on the page, it slows the narrative down. Daughters of the North, as I said, it was an exercise in storytelling, pure straight storytelling. And so it is very difficult. It's a very difficult problem to kind of tackle the idea of investigating these notions while also allowing the story to kind of to do what it's going to do, to kind of retain its anatomy and walk the way it wants to walk. So in the editing of the novel, lots was taken out to make it the kind of lean book that it is. And some of my thinking on the page was taken out. Perhaps some of it could have been left in, but for the purposes of this novel, it was about the story. It was less about my thought behind it. So, you know, I mean, it could be that it's been stripped down. You know, like like these women fighters are kind of stripped down to the basics. The book is stripped down to the basics as well.
Interesting. Mm. But I mean, if there is additional thought, if there is complexity here, I mean, this is a trade-off because on one hand, yes, you have to keep the narrative going, but I would argue that you can have just as much of a page-turner with a little bit extra thought put in there, because in fact you might even cause more manipulation on the reader, and isn't that great, you know?
Yeah, certainly, and again, it comes down to choice. I mean, you choose aspects of the novel, so I didn't want to focus on romances or emotional relationships. I wanted to focus on working relationships and manipulative relationships and kind of power structures and hierarchies. So the focus in the book is very much on what Sister thinks of Jackie Nixon. She admires Jackie Nixon. She's afraid of her. She wants to do her bidding. She wants to be approved of by her. She hears Jackie Nixon talking, and the words that she's saying are the words that she's always tried to come up with in her own head about the situation. And that was a deliberate choice, that kind of moving away from romantic relationships. I think Horsewater contains perhaps more of that than the other novels do.
Yeah.
Electric Michelangelo, again, there's a kind of short, sharp romance.
Yeah.
I buy the romance
in Electric Michelangelo more than the other two, I think.
Yeah.
Because there is a build-up, you know? Okay, well, anyway. Sarah, thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
No, you're welcome.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. We'll have to do this again.
So.